Before we start today's show, tell you to head on over to the Oxford Exxon and the Oxford Crystal Highway 6 West. Get the Kool-Aid slushies, $1.49 for grape, $1.49 for green apple. They're made with Sprite. They're delicious. They're great for summer. Also, cold cream and delicious hand-spun milkshakes. We got chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, and Oreo there when you head on over on Highway 6 West. Lunch specials, ribs, much more at the Oxford Exxon and the Oxford Crystal. Remember, now a blue sky convenience store there with the Oxford Exxon, so check them out for those summer treats. Also, we're coming to you from the Clark Ford studio, where you don't have to worry about haggling. You just call Corey Clark, 257-1900, that's 662 on an area code, Highway 25 South in Amory. He gives you the best deal you can get. You can shop it around. You can not shop it around. You will get the best deal from Corey and those guys at Clark Ford, and when you tell them that you heard it on the podcast at the end, you get $500 extra off, so you can't beat that between Clark Ford and the Oxford Exxon. Now let's get on with the show.
From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MPW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Welcome to this Wednesday edition of the Oxford Exxon Podcast. Chase Parm, Neil McCready, coming to you from the Clark Ford studio. Today, another slow day, a couple weeks here of not much going on. It'll pick up soon enough. SEC Media Days, if nothing else, gives us interviews and fodder, so that is not far off. Today on the show, a lengthy interview with Brett Basham, former Ole Miss baseball player. He was one of the assistants with Mike Bianco when he coached the collegiate national team with Jim Schlossnagel a couple years ago. Also was at LSU Eunice when Stuart Turner was there prior to coming to Ole Miss, the Johnny Bench Award winner, now a Cincinnati Red. So we'll talk to him just about his time, ask him some different questions, get a few stories, some different things from Brett here as we pass time in the summer without a whole lot going on. Thanks to all of you for listening, for going on iTunes, subscribing, all those things. We appreciate you every single day for that. Neil, how are you this morning?
I am good. I'm looking forward to our conversation about the play at second base yesterday.
Are you?
I actually am.
Okay. Last night, Florida wins the College World Series. They beat LSU, I guess 6-1 was the final, or 6-2 something, I don't know. It was much closer earlier in the game, but Florida broke it out in their last at bat, so we'll discuss that. Florida, another school added, I think the first SEC school to have national championships in football, basketball, and baseball, and they've done all three in the last 10 years. You know, you can say what you want to about how much impact he had, but Scott Strickland's had a pretty good first 12 months or so on the job, national championships in baseball, track and field, and women's tennis, I believe, to this point.
Hi.
Not a bad time to be a Gator.
I'm sorry, you broke up on me there. 1 second.
Do I know?
Yeah, it's a lot easier to get it done at Florida than it is Mississippi State, that's for sure.
Think so?
Just a little. A little more resources. It's kind of along the lines of all the conversations we have about coaching and all that stuff. And people can talk about the importance of coaching and the importance of people and jobs. There are some jobs that are simply easier than others. It's not to take anything away from what Scott does or doesn't do. It's easier to get it done at Florida than it is at a lot of places.
A little bit of state news yesterday. A bit of surprising. They had drug tests during the LSU Super Regional between the Tigers and the Bulldogs. Peyton Plumlee, pitcher that was probably going to have a big-time role next year, was a good relief option out of the pen, failed his test, suspended for 1 year from the time of the test, so stayed already without another arm for 2018.
Wow. What did he test positive for? Steroids or just...
I don't know. I honestly didn't even look at it that close, but I saw he was out 365 days from the date of the. I think LSU eliminated them June 11th, so sometime in that weekend.
So he'll be ready for the College World Series next year, but not until.
I mean, in all seriousness, if you're Canizero, you can't even put him on your 35 for the year, right? There's no way you hold a spot just for a postseason.
No, you have to let him go.
Yeah. It's kind of what I was thinking, too.
he's probably eating up what, half a scholarship?
I don't know.
Yeah, got to go.
They did get a transfer in from Tulane, J.P. France. Probably help him. Probably a weekend starter next year, potentially for the Bulldogs. But anyway, just saw that. So today on the show, we'll talk College World Series. We'll talk the two Vanderbilt football players that took a pellet gun to a gunfight and end up getting shot. Non-critical, so it can be a little make fun of them a little more than we would otherwise. And then a lot of legislation going on to the Supreme Court about sports gambling. Interesting couple different things with that today as well on the show. We'll open with College World Series, though. So Florida wins. LSU, very non-LSU last night, a team that had never finished second in the country because the six previous times they had gotten to the finals, they had won it. Last night, a lot of early errors, some weird coaching decisions, some really dumb mental mistakes late, including what you're talking about, and more. Florida just didn't beat itself and erode elite pitching and defense to a national title.
Well, first of all, congratulations to Florida. I don't know the coach, anything like that, so congratulations to them. Secondly, if you're LSU, that is going to be a difficult. It's one thing to get your butt kicked and to walk off a field going, well, they're better than us. It's another thing to have that game in your hands, your ace ready to go, the other team's bullpen shot to hell. If there's a third game, it's advantage LSU today. And if you're the runner, I can't remember the kid's name, at first base.
I think it was Slaughter.
It was Slaughter. He had just come up with a big hit.
He had.
You can, the one thing you can't do in that spot, first and third, nobody out, your team down a run, seventh inning. The one thing you can't do is create an interference play. Anything else you do on that ground, your best bet on that double play ground ball is just to lay down. Get out of the way. The double play hurts, but it ties the game. You can look out there and see that they're playing corners at regular depth where they might come home on a hard hit ground ball. But the middle infield is playing double play depth.
Giving the run up.
You see that as a base runner, and you say they are conceding the run for the double play. The one thing I can't do is create any sort of an interference play at second base while they're trying to turn a double play. And he goes in with a dirty slide. I'm not crazy about the rule. I know I contradict myself on baseball stuff all the time. I'm not crazy about the rule. Sometimes I like the aggressive play at second, but some of the injuries that have happened, I understand why baseball says, hey, we can't have that. You know the rule, and you violate the ever-living hell out of the rule.
See, I didn't think it was that egregious. His legs are still over the bag. He makes contact with kind of his hip and his butt going in, and it wasn't like it was a complete takeout on the slide. And now, look, was it dumb? Yes. I'm not excusing the play because he easily had an easier line to the bag.
But he went in spikes high.
And I'll also, and I'm being a little bit of devil's advocate just for the sake of the conversation, the rule states that it is interference if the fielder is impacted. He made the play. I could argue he wasn't impacted.
You could.
There's an out.
The thing about it is the runner, as he goes in, and look, I watch a lot of Major League Baseball. Maybe the rules are different. In the major leagues, you have to be, when the slide is complete, you have to be in contact with the bag or able to touch the bag.
In college baseball, the only difference is, and I'm pretty sure here, I think I'm right, I think I saw somebody else say this as well, you can go through the bag in college. So the contact after the bag, I don't believe is relevant.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point, and I know what you're saying, and again, I don't like the rule. I don't like the rule. I like a little bit more of the old school baseball where you slide into second base, and damn it, this in this case, the shortstop gets the hell out of the way. he was in the way. It was easy to slide in and make contact. But in that spot, Slaughter has to be smarter. The first base coach has to be smarter. You have to say, hey, man, whatever you do, clean slide. Whatever you do, clean slide. Don't go in with your spikes high. Don't go in where you give the umpire an opportunity. Or in this case, I'm sure the umpire was thinking, aw, damn it. Where the umpire has to enforce the rule, and he did. Because when I watched it, the first replay, I went, he's out. It's a good call. That's the rule.
Yeah, my only major issue is that that slide happens 80% of the time on those plays, and it's never called. Not saying that's right or wrong. It's really wrong the other way. Call it every time then. But when it's selectively in that situation, that bothers me. Because I watch a lot of college baseball, and that slide happens the majority of the time.
Yeah, just...
It's a spike into the top of the in the bottom of the shin. By the rule, I get it. It's illegal. It is. It's illegal. But he didn't hit him in the waist with it.
Oh, no.
And I hate the angle that everybody's making. Like, I kind of had a back and forth with Ryan McGee of ESPN last night about it. Because he had the picture. They're showing this weird angle from kind of the left field corner, and it makes it look much worse than it was. Not saying it was right, but that angle makes it look a lot worse. It's not a straight on view.
Right. No, I haven't even seen the picture. I just watched the replay over and over and over, and I thought,
right.
I just kept, the more I watched it, the more I thought, how dumb.
Well, there's no way the umpires wanted to make that call because the officiating has been atrocious during this College World Series, and it's just another thing they had to deal with. They got it right. I mean, this wasn't like some of the bad stuff. I mean, there's been times during this College World Series where they didn't even understand the functionality of the replay system and what they could replay and what they couldn't replay. I mean, this wasn't that. But.
Yeah. And then as the game went on, they had another opportunity an inning later. Couldn't get a run in from third.
Robertson got through out of the
play. The first baseman made a really nice play.
He did.
And then they took the suspense away. Bottom of the eighth. That is what a championship team does.
And I'm glad they did. It erased anything to do with the other stuff. So
it at least lessened it. You wonder how the game's different if it's 2-2 they are going to the eighth.
Of course.
Now there's a different level of pressure on Florida.
But, I mean, you said it. Look, Florida, they go to Cower there in the eighth. I mean, they were throwing their third-game starter in this game because they knew they were probably screwed tomorrow.
They knew had there been a game today, they were going to be a prohibitive underdog.
Yeah.
They were going to have to beat Alex Lang with Johnny Holstaff. Does that happen? It happens. Does it happen often? No. I'll give the guy credit. O'Sullivan, he said, hey, we have a one-game lead. This of the two games, this is the one where we perhaps are at least equal or have an advantage. Let's go get it.
They did. My gut tells me that he stays put now. If he loses, I think he's the head coach at South Carolina this week. They've been waiting on Kevin O'Sullivan. Ray Tanner hasn't made a hire yet. But if you've won the national title, do you go to a division rival?
South Carolina's a better job.
It is. Much better
job. And now that he's won the title, the whole Ray Tanner.
I don't know. I mean, Florida may be a better overall job. Carolina cares more and gives you a different environment. I mean, he told me talent around it and just resources. I might pick Florida.
I mean, look at last night, for example. That stadium, they might as well have played that game in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
Florida travels to nothing. They had that basketball team with Corey Brewer and Al Horford and Joakim Noah and all those guys, and they didn't. It wasn't electric down there when they went to the tournament. They didn't carry a lot of people. It's a different fan base. I'm just thinking now that he's won a title, some of the stuff that hurt his predecessor, his potential predecessor there at South Carolina, wouldn't hurt him. The Carolina fans would say, well, this guy's won a title. He knows what he's doing. They wouldn't clamor for Ray Tanner every time that an inning went wrong.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, Holbrook was Tanner's guy. Had only been an assistant on that staff. He was at a disadvantage from that standpoint.
Yeah. What's Holbrook doing, by the way?
I don't know that he's done anything yet or not. He had a couple assistant coach opportunities, but if he took one of them, I've missed it along the way. And I haven't paid Tennessee that close attention. But do what?
Did Tennessee make a hire?
Yeah, they hired the assistant at Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, anyway. Well,
all this and Ole Miss hadn't fired anyone yet. Unbelievable.
No, they've had an ops opening and a strength opening.
Congratulations to Florida. They were a good team, and they're champs. And if you're LSU, that's going to be an off season that takes a little while to get over.
Losing a lot too. I mean, got a lot back. They're always going to be talented, but Lang, Poche, Kramer Robertson, Greg Dykeman.
Yeah, a lot of guys who've won a lot of big games there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Eric Walker back next year, but I mean, he's been hurt, hadn't pitched in the College World Series, or at least maybe since the first game. So we'll see. But again, yeah, Florida wins it. LSU finishes second. The SEC got to promote and beat its chest again for a few days. That was fun. And now we move forward. It's football season now as that ends. As I've been telling you about, check out Right Way Meds, located in Holly Springs, but wherever you are, they deliver your medicine to your door. Just check them out at rightwaymeds.com, 888-252-3773. That's 888-252-3773. Comes in strip packets where you tear off the first dose of the day. Next dose ready when you are. They help you manage that medication. It can save lives, or it can just save you time, whatever you need. Also, if you're a doctor or medical provider, ask them how they can help. Your compliance numbers.
Podcast also brought to you by Journey Business Solutions. If you're a small business owner, you know Visa's rules recently changed, allowing owners to pass credit card processing costs on to their customer as a line item along with sales tax. Journey Business Solutions has a fully integrated solution to make that simple for business owners. You just swipe the card just like you do today, and you pay zero for credit card processing. Journey Business Solutions also has the latest and greatest technology with Apple Pay, EMV chip processing, next day funding, and more. If you're ready for something more than the terminal, Ben Brown and the team has a tablet point of sale system that does inventory, marketing, loyalty rewards, employee scheduling, and time cards. It makes your life much easier, and it normally costs $1,200. But you let Ben know you heard about it on the podcast. You get it at no cost, and you still save monthly versus what you are paying to process today. Journey Business Solutions can do business nationwide. They often work with merchants previously declined and can get you out of your contract. Send Ben an email at benbrown@journeybizsolutions.com. The process is very easy, and he will get back with you right away to get you started. Remember that registration for Oxford Park Commission Youth Soccer for the fall 2017 season is currently underway. It's going on through July the 7th. Cost is $55 per child. There's a multi-child discount available. The age range is 4 to 16. It's classified via year of birth. This year, the season will begin in late August and run through October. Schedules will be posted 2 weeks before the season starts. The games are played at FNC Park, and you can find out more at oxfordparkcommission.com. Podcast also brought to you by Gambrell & Associates. Gambrell & Associates have three attorneys with more than 60 years of combined experience and more than 45 years handling only bankruptcy and Social Security disability claims. Check out their website at msbnkr.com. Or by searching for Robert Gambrell on superlawyers.com or avvo.com. You should know Super Lawyers only selects the top 5% of lawyers in the state for their listings. Gambrell & Associates handle Social Security disability claims statewide and in Memphis. For more information, call the office in Hernando, 662-342-7700, or in Oxford at 662-281-8800.
guy in Arkansas making news this morning. Did you see this, where he toppled the Ten Commandments monument that was installed on Tuesday?
No, I didn't see that. Did it intentionally?
Apparently. A 6-foot-tall stone Ten Commandments monument that was installed Tuesday on the Arkansas Capitol grounds was toppled less than 24 hours later after a 32-year-old Arkansas man drove a vehicle into the statue. That driver, identified in an arrest report as Michael Tate Reed of Van Buren, Arkansas, was arrested by Capitol Police shortly after. He had also been previously accused of destroying a Ten Commandments monument in Oklahoma. So there's that. In a Facebook Live video to an account under the name Michael Reed, a driver appears to shine his headlights on the monument and shouts freedom as he drives toward it. As the vehicle hits the granite, the video cuts out.
Yeah, he's going to have a hard time claiming it was an accident.
Facebook Live video, probably not helping his case much here.
It's probably hurting him. But if he wanted to make a point, I guess he did.
He did something. So, all right, moving on back to SEC football. Have you read much on this Vanderbilt thing?
I was going to get you to help me out. I saw something about it last night. My internet wasn't very good. And I couldn't, and I was doing something else, and I couldn't find it. Fill me in.
All right. Well, two Vanderbilt football players, Frank Coppett, Tay Daly, both 18 years old, I'm assuming freshmen. I don't know. Police called it a, quote, ill-conceived plan to recover a teammate's stolen cell phone. They both received non-critical birdshot wounds to the one to the leg, one to the arm. 19-year-old Donovan Tennyson, I don't know, he'd offered his phone for sale on an internet site, and he met with a prospective buyer at a Chili's parking lot at 5 p.m. on Monday. 5 p.m., nothing crazy. Tennyson told police his phone was stolen during the meeting and later that night was offered for sale on the same internet site. So he says someone stole his phone and then offered it for sale. Tennyson said he arranged a meeting with the seller in a Target parking lot and arrived with Daly and Coppett. Police said the three players brought a pellet pistol, which one of them said was to, quote, help get the phone back. Police said Coppett got out of Daly's Toyota with the pellet pistol in his hand when a man pulled up next to them in a Buick, got out and shot at the players with an actual pistol. Police said another man in the Buick fired a shotgun at them. Police said one gunman fled in the Buick and another left in the Toyota after the shots were fired. Did not say if or when anyone got out of the other car. So again, one is a freshman from Warner Robins, Georgia. One a redshirt freshman from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They are defensive backs. So anyway, Vanderbilt gives a statement that says their foremost concern is the well-being of our students, and appears the injuries are not life-threatening. They are monitoring the situation. You know, when you walk up to the number one, probably not a good situation to be in. Probably not the best cast of characters to be around or try to get or retrieve a cell phone from. When you take a pellet gun that looks like a real gun to a meeting and flash it, you kind of ask for getting shot, in my opinion.
Yeah, things kind of get real at that point. That's not very smart. Over a cell phone? That's stupid.
They're not showing an intelligent level that would lead me to believe they would be at Vanderbilt without the football program.
So are you saying that you think some of the guys who play football at Vanderbilt don't meet the academic requirements required of the regular student body? Because that's one hell of an accusation there.
It is a bit of an accusation, and it is one that I support, that there could be some case-by-case basis that help out Vanderbilt's football program, that if said person was an engineering major and not a student-athlete, would not be the case.
And I realize that happens everywhere, don't get me wrong, but it's one of the narratives that I hate that the lazy media does with Vanderbilt. Well, one of the reasons that it's hard at Vanderbilt is because the academics stop. Stop. The academics at Vanderbilt are no harder than the academics at Ole Miss or Alabama or any place else. It's harder to get in, and it's more expensive, but if you're on a football scholarship, it wasn't harder to get in, and you're not paying for it.
Yeah.
But the media does that all the time. Well, these are really smart kids because they're at Vanderbilt. They're no smarter or dumber, with exceptions, but there are exceptions everywhere. There's kids on the Ole Miss team who are smarter than other kids on the Ole Miss team. There are kids at Arkansas who are smarter than other kids at Arkansas. But people do that with Vanderbilt all the time. Well, one of the real challenges is that it's just so academically demanding. No, it's not. Shut up.
Well, the same thing happens when you have NFL players that have gone to some of these schools. When they do something stupid, and you go, well, that makes no sense because he went to blank. It's like,
yeah, he went to Stanford. Yeah, on a football scholarship.
Saying your money's still on the aerospace engineer guy?
What's that?
Your money's still on the aerospace engineer guy on the ACT test is what you're telling me?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
And I realize there are exceptions, but there aren't many exceptions.
Yeah, of course there are exceptions. Exceptions to everything. But
yeah, I mean, there's no... But as a rule, the guys who play football at Vanderbilt are there because they can play football.
Just so stupid.
Yeah, what are you thinking? You get out with a pistol? I mean, if someone gets out with a pistol, it's like people use the toy pistol. It's so stupid. In a heated moment like that, you see a pistol, you don't look to see, hey, is that plastic or metal?
Yeah, if they escalated the situation, no matter what the situation was going to be before that.
It's a wonder nobody got killed.
I mean, basically, just because the other people only had birdshot. Somebody might have been killed if they'd had something else.
No doubt.
20 years ago today, Mike Tyson biting Evander Holyfield's ear.
Has it been that long?
It was June 28th, 1997.
I'll tell you this, you probably remember this a little bit, to show you how things change. Tyson in his prime, when he had a fight, and this is a bit hyperbolic, but the world stopped for a Mike Tyson fight. Tyson Holyfield was one of those fights that you found a place to go watch that fight. You paid the penalty. You watched that fight. You found a way to watch that fight. 20 years later, boxing, there's no one in boxing to Mayweather to a degree, maybe, but really no one in boxing that makes the world stop
for the fight. In my opinion, and again, it's very, very layman. I mean, Ben and Hip or somebody would have a much better idea than me. It almost kind of takes a heavyweight or someone with punching power. Mayweather's technical skill is as good as there's ever been, but most people that watch boxing where it stops the world, you want to see power and knockouts. I mean, some people rubberneck and watch car crashes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you want to see power.
The Rocky movies would not have been as successful if he was a cruiserweight.
Well, it's why, look, I mean, I contend, and maybe he's not as good as those guys. I don't know. I know nothing about boxing. In a different era, I think Deontay Wilder would have been an international superstar.
Oh, I do too.
6'5", 6'7", whatever he is. Dude punches so hard he breaks his own hand.
Yeah.
He'd have been fun in the 90s against Riddick Bowe and Holyfield, Lennox Lewis, and those guys. Different deal now, though.
Yeah, totally different. And he could actually walk down the street in most towns in America and he wouldn't be recognized.
Right. Holyfield at the time said, it didn't really hurt that much, to be honest. The ear ain't nothing but flesh. There's no bone there. My only thing was I wanted to get him back for doing that to me. That's what I was thinking. But it didn't hurt none. I just had to get it stitched up. So.
I would think someone biting off your earlobe would hurt.
I think Don King was almost kind of glad it happened because it gave him something else to promote.
Oh, sure. But it was... I mean, this story's been told so many times. Mike Tyson, with just a different supporting cast and a little more maturity. That guy was unbeatable for the longest time.
Yeah.
Unbeatable. You couldn't survive a round with him.
there's a video going around of Customata talking about him when he was really, really young. It's like a 2-minute video or something, really interesting if you want to find it on the internet, before Tyson became Tyson, when he was like 16 or something.
Yeah, and that was the turning point in his career in a negative way. Customata was so much to him. And when he passed, even though he went on and became champion and was great for a while, he was kind of out of control.
Yeah. So, all right, let's go talk to Brett Basham a little bit. Again, a lot of different baseball topics here. We will come back from that interview. We'll discuss some sports gambling. The Supreme Court is going to hear a case that could have a major effect on it. So now, Brett Basham on the Rebel Locker Room Hotline. Brett, thanks for taking some time with us this morning. You got done playing. You've gone off into leadership at some different things. Are you going to become another Brian Cain on us?
No, not quite. It's been a different kind of path since I've gotten done playing, and just trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and tried my hand in coaching, but really kind of enjoyed the team building and leadership aspect of it. Of baseball, and so kind of been a few different places, done a few different things, and kind of settled on where I'm at now. And I enjoy it, and that's it's a good time for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into a good bit of stuff, but you were, I guess you had dealt with Stuart Turner before he headed to Oxford back in the day, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess that's my coaching claim to fame, if you will, because the couple of years that I coached, I was down in Eunice, Louisiana, at LSU Eunice, the fall of 11 and spring of 12 in that season. And when I first took the job down there, they said that, they were telling me about this kid. He's like, he's really good. Didn't do the whole summer ball circuit in high school because he played football too. And so never really got to travel and do all those tournaments. And, LSU didn't really take any hard looks at him or anything. And so you're going to be really impressed. And so I saw him play, and, over time it didn't really take a trained eye to see that Stuart was going to be really good. And so what I did was I immediately text Laff, and I said, Laff, do you guys need a catcher? Because I got one down here that you really need to take a look at. And so we just got to talking. And anyways, that next weekend, so this was in like September. So that next weekend, in junior college, you play tournaments on the weekends in the fall. And so he sent Cliff Godwin down to, we were playing a tournament in Natchitoches, Louisiana at Northwestern State. And we played a doubleheader that day, and I think Stuart went like 4-for-8 or 4-for-9, had like 2 doubles and threw a bunch of guys out and just had a really good day. And Cliff left like halfway through the second game. He's like, I've seen all I need to see. We're going to get him up on a visit. And, next thing you know, he signs and goes up there and has a really good year and, wins the Johnny Bench Award. And so it kind of made me look like I knew what I was talking about. So.
I didn't really plan on asking a ton about Stuart, but when he came in, everybody knew about his defense. Nobody was really sure that he could hit to the level that he ends up hitting. Because he wins the bench award based off both sides of his game, and he's still been serviceable enough even now with getting some action for the Reds this season. Were you surprised at maybe how his offense developed over time?
To the extent that it did, I was a little bit surprised. I didn't know he was going to hit like 400. I always thought he was a 330 guy with maybe, 6 to 8 home runs, something like that, like 45, 50 RBIs. I didn't know that he was going to do that. I think his stance was like really narrow at Eunice, and it seemed like it always felt more comfortable to him to narrow his stance a little bit. But I think when he got to Ole Miss, he kind of widened out a little bit. And I think that helped him generate a little bit more power. He's a little bit more balanced. And that helped him, in the overall grand scheme of his swing. And just really had a good year and took off. And I'm not really surprised that he had the success that he did. I just didn't know it was going to be like that good, if that makes any sense.
I don't know how much you saw this past season, but obviously plenty of people had heard about him, and then he had a very up-and-down year coming on there at the end. I guess any impressions whatsoever of Cooper Johnson, and then just what he would have had to deal with. Really, probably, I'm thinking, I went back and looked, because I knew you, that you didn't play a ton that first year or anything. Maybe Mike's first true freshman catcher that's just been handed the keys like he did.
Yeah, he's the first one, and that's what I... I think he's going to be really good. I really do. I think he's going to be really good. He's already, playing defense at a high level. The hitting is, it's going to come. Obviously, you go from playing in high school, and he obviously has the accolades and things of playing in the Under Armour game and stuff like that. So, but still in high school, you're not facing the SEC arms night in and night out like you are when you get to a place like Ole Miss. And so, I think for Cooper, I don't think you have to be, and this is what happened to me at an early age, not necessarily as a freshman, but, when I started as a sophomore, is you don't have to come in and be like the person that this all world person that you're supposed to be, or people think you're supposed to be. Just go out and be who you are. Just go out and play and throw people out and block balls and receive at a high level. And, when runners are on base, move them over, drive them in or something. You just simplify the game. And I think, too, is when you come in that highly touted, I think it happened with Hightower a little bit, too, is we're so quick to anoint these people as, like, the second coming or whatever. And then at the first sign of failure, or at the first sign of them, looking like they're not, looking like they're not having success, or looking like they're not going to be able to handle it, we tend to like give up on them and things like that. So I think that what Cooper Johnson needs to do is, and take it for what it's worth, I guess, but it's just go back to like what got him there, Just being a really, really elite defender, and then, just getting used to getting at bats with, I think you saw he was playing up in the Cape this summer, but just getting at bats against elite level arms, and all of a sudden, the 93s to 95s, you start getting used to that velocity, and you start getting used to the breaking balls that are at 80 to 85 miles an hour. You start getting used to that stuff, and you start to get into a rhythm, and then you become the player that everybody thinks that you're going to be. So I think that, I just kind of watched from afar this year, and I could definitely tell because I've experienced it myself. I just think you try too hard and you try to do too much because so much is expected of you. But it's hard, man. Playing for Coach B and Coach Laff as a catcher is not easy. That every single pass ball or wild pitch is your fault. It's not the pitcher's fault. So they motivate you to be better than you ever thought that you could be. And so over a period of 3 or 4 years, you will see your game develop. But it's tough at the beginning. There's a lot of different things that they demand of you. And, I'm glad that I chose to come to Ole Miss just because, I don't think if I went anywhere else, it would have led to me becoming the defender that I ultimately became.
Ole Miss sent 9 kids to the Cape this year. You mentioned that you spent time with Bourne up there as well. At this point, because it's changed over the years, is it more of a scouting league, more of an instructional league? I mean, what are these kids getting out of that at this point, other than just more at bats, or is that absolutely what they're getting? And those reps are very important.
I think it's I feel like it's more like the scouting league. I think it's obviously I played in the Cape 10 years ago, and so yeah. I don't know what it is to exactly to this day, but I feel like there were 10 or 15 people at any given time scout wise that were checking every game that's being played on Cape Cod on a nightly basis. And so you're definitely getting the good exposure against, you know, the top talent. Obviously, that's not playing for, you know, the USA collegiate national team. You're getting, like, the next wave of really good talent. And so, you know, I think it's a way for scouts to gauge how you are on a nightly basis and how you're able to handle, you know, playing every single day against that, you know, elite level type talent. So yeah, it was, I really enjoyed my time there. I think it helped me gain a lot of confidence, after my, you know, my sophomore year, which I didn't have a very good year, kind of helped me gain a lot of confidence, facing a bunch of big leaguers every night.
You mentioned just being a catcher under Mike and it being difficult. Everybody, and this is a topic that comes up all the time, and I don't know that you and I have maybe even discussed it. You always see Mike give the signals in and whatnot, but what input from a development standpoint and into the game does the catcher have, whether it be plan, calling pitches, anything as that kind of matures and develops throughout the season, a game, or even a career? What is kind of the maturation of learning from him and then also having an input in that?
Well, I think like anything, he wants you to not need him. And what I mean by that is he wants you thinking for yourself. He wants you to provide input, and pay attention to how we pitch certain people or how we pitch different spots of the lineup, how we pitch certain situations and things like that. But he does, it's not that he doesn't want to call the catchers to call pitches. That was never like his intent. I think the intent of why he calls pitches is because he has all the information right there at his disposal. He has the scouting reports. He has, you know, the pitcher for the next day, the starting pitcher for the next day is always there keeping the chart. So they just have a wealth of information, or he does, you know, when he's there in the dugout calling pitches. So, what he does is, you know, we were always able to, talk with him and laugh regarding we would always do it like Thursday before of the lineup, the scouting report, and you know, who we got to watch out for, who can't beat us, and things like that. How are we going to pitch certain people? And so, you know, you learn early on, the system and, you know, how, you know, the tendencies that Coach B has when he's calling pitches and things like that. And so, you know, as a freshman playing, you know, I played, just some spot playing. You know, it took me a little while to learn. But once you get that game time, then as a sophomore and even as a junior and senior, you know, you start to understand, you start to know, like, what he's going to call before he calls it. It got to be one of those things where, you know, I could guess, or have an educated guess of what he's going to call based on the situation or based on who's hitting, you know, what spot we're at in the game, things like that. And so there are very few times where he'd call something where I was surprised by it, just to put it that way. And then as I mentioned, I got a little bit older and he kind of turned, some of the game over to me. No, that wasn't a whole lot, but you know, there were times where he just pointed to me, meaning that, like, you got it. And he just kind of sat back and watched. So yeah, it's a lot of education. It's a lot of coaching at the beginning. Just trying to learn. It's a very intricate set of signals too. We have like four different like sets of signals. And, you know, I think they're, you know, towards the end of my career, they started going to the wristband system and the number system, which I think helps. But so now you essentially have like five sets of signals, too. So it's a lot to learn. You know, for a young guy, it's a lot to learn. And, you know, at the beginning, I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get this. And then the more you pay attention, the more you listen, the more you're in game situations, you find yourself just all of a sudden picking it up somehow. And, but it was, it's pretty cool. You know, I look at myself as a freshman to the time I was a junior and senior, and you know, it was like night and day, you know, just how quickly he could relay the signal, you know, to the pitcher and kind of understand the system and things like that. Just help for, you know, a lot of things like speed of the game and, you know, helping our pitcher stay in a rhythm and things like that.
So we take a break in the interview. Let me tell you about Community Mortgage, located in Oxford, Memphis, Settle County, and Chattanooga, 30 years old this year. All underwriting and processing is done in Memphis, so you're getting local underwriting and understands your market. Also the leader in condo financing in Oxford. Ask Jason Lowe about Community Mortgage's float-down option, which allows you to lock in the current rate, but if rates go down before you close, you get the lower rate. You can contact Jason at 662-234-2704 or JLowe, J-L-O-W-E, at communitymtg.com.
The podcast is also brought to you by Oxford University Bank. OUB gives you the comfort of home and all the benefits the big mega banks provide. It does it with all the technology and products you can want, all with the personal touch. When you call OUB, you speak directly with a live person, all without having to press 10 buttons and without a 5-minute wait. OUB is also home to the Kasasa cash checking account. With Kasasa, OUB will pay you 2.5% interest on your balance up to $50,000, refund ATM fees nationwide. It also features free online bill pay and the mobile check deposit using the app. Run your CDs right now at OUB, 1.75% APY. The 3-year triple option CD is 2.01% APY. And with that, you can deposit once during the term, withdraw once during the term, and or bump the rate if their 3-year CD rate rises. To learn more about OUB, check out liveoxfordbankoxford.com or call 662-234-6668. OUB is FDIC insured. The podcast is also brought to you by Michael Oswalt. Michael's a realtor, specializes in recreational and timberland tracts across the state of Mississippi. He works with Tom Smith Land and Homes. It's by far the largest broker of land in Mississippi. Look up his site. It's gotland.com. That's got-land.com. You can read his recent testimonials. You can check out his track record and look at the properties online that he has listed. Here's the deal. The land market's very hot right now. If you're on the fence about selling your land, your hunting club share, or your home with acreage, now's the time. Give Michael a call today. He's ready to meet with you, explain the process. If he can't earn your business in that meeting, he'll tell you he doesn't deserve it. There's three ways to get in contact with him. Call his cell, 662-719-3967. Visit his Facebook page or send him an email, michael@tomsmithland.com. Now back to the show.
Assuming it was you, I don't remember what happened. Was it completely turned over to the players when he was ever tossed? I mean, I know he was thrown out in Hoover that year in 07.
Well, Kyle Bunn actually stepped in and called the pitches. But, you know, it was kind of awkward, too, because, you know, Coach Bunn wasn't ready to step in there and give signals. I mean, he was from a preparedness standpoint, from knowing the system, knowing what to call, you know, having a feel for the game. But as far as like, hey, I'm here in the bullpen warming up the next guy that's supposed to go in, and all of a sudden I'm like thrown into the fire and I'm calling pitches. And so, he kind of gave us, you know, some freedom on that too. So it was kind of just like a mixed thing. I think it was just so out of the ordinary really, because it didn't really happen that much, but we got a little bit of freedom there.
I'm going to scatter shoot at these few things here that I've never asked you about, and I just want to hear if you have any closer stories to this. So Arizona State, Super Regional 07, the near brawl on the field, because from my angle, okay, Eric Sogard of Arizona State is out there. He ends up somehow between Kleeman Fuller and Evan Button, who appear to be three of the more hot-headed people on Ole Miss's team if you're going to run in the middle of three people. And somehow that ends up with Mike and Pat Murphy. And just the picture of the two of them side by side and the size differentials cracks me up to this day, with Mike jawing in his Italian way that he can at Pat. From the field angle, take me through those couple minutes.
So I guess what started it was there was a rundown between third base and home, and so Evan was playing first. It was Cody Overbeck and Kleeman were, I think, the ones that were mostly involved. And so Kleeman ended up running Eric Sogard back to third base and tagged him out. But I think he pushed him down because, you know, they're running and, you know, Sogard puts on the brakes and Kleeman kind of runs into him, and you know, that can be construed as a hard tag or whatever. And so Sogard gets up and pushes Kleeman, and then, you know, benches start to clear, and it was unreal. Like, this is like the first time that I've ever been in something like this, and so I was like just kind of looking around. I didn't really know what to do, and so Evan Button was playing first, I remember, and Evan goes to the on deck batter. I don't remember who it was. Kinds and gets in between, and Evan Button runs from first base on a dead sprint, and like, I don't know, confronts the guy on deck and like rips the bat out of his hand. And I thought he was going to use it on him. You know, I was kind of like nervous for the guy, you know, because Evan's got that hockey toughness mentality, and so that was kind of interesting for Evan to kind of sprint in there and grab the bat out of the guy's hand. And then, you know, Coach B and Pat Murphy get into it, and, you know, they're shouting, oh, there's, you know, some things that obviously can't be repeated, that they were kind of saying back and forth. And what was interesting is Coach Bunn, you know, he's like 6'4", 6'5", just 240, just built like a bodybuilder out there, and he's the one that's like breaking them up, where he... You know, you would think he would be the guy that would be getting into it. No, he's the one out there breaking Coach B up. And so, you know, kind of when the dust settled and everything, and you ask Coach B, he's like, Coach, you think you could handle him? He's like, yeah, I had him. There's no question. There's no doubt. There's no doubt that I had him. And so, different things like that. So it was pretty funny.
When Mike gets all fiery like that, does he just immediately, once it's over, calm back down and go back into his normal little mode, if you will?
Yeah, he just takes a deep breath and kind of gets right back into it. It's pretty funny. You know, he'll, you know, especially when he gets on umpires and stuff like that, he'll come out there and, you know, he has a pretty interesting way of going about. He's always has a really good argument for why he's out there, and some of the time he just to hear umpires come back with some of their responses to Coach B's arguing, it's kind of interesting because they don't always know what to say. They're kind of just really flustered, and he kind of gets the best of them because when he comes out there to argue, I mean, he has a really legitimate point. He's really good at kind of getting his point across and making the other guy feel like you 100% missed that call and there's nothing you can say to make it any better. And, you know, I've seen some guys that that were pretty flustered, to say the least, when he's come out there and ripped into them pretty good.
Okay, so hold on. It's not simply just calling you names and whatever. It's going through the play. I mean, we're being descriptive with exactly what happened here or what? Kind of take me through it.
Oh, yeah. He's like a human rule book. He'll go out there and he'll... It's a good way of kind of going out there and stating his case, and he'll say, "Hey, here's, you know, you're sure about that? You're 100% sure because this is what I saw, and you're telling me that this is what you saw and this is what happened, and just different things like that." And he said, "You know, he'll kind of intimidate, you know, for being like as." Small as he is, he obviously has a very intimidating presence about him, and he'll basically, I guess, what by the end of the argument, he'll kind of state his case. Here's the rule. Here's my interpretation of the rule, and here's what happened. And so, you know, there are maybe some name calling in there. There may be a few expletives to where you screwed that up, to say it politely, but. Usually by the end, the umpires are pretty flustered, and he's got his two cents in there, and, you know, they may even say that, hey, I missed that one, which has happened a few times.
What's the leeway that coaches get most of the time out there before they get run?
Well, I guess my experience is if an umpire misses a call, no matter if it's ball strikes, they're usually a little less tolerant on that, but, you know, a bang bang play at a base or something like that, they make a call and they're not exactly sure whether it was, they just have to make a call right there. I think they'll give coaches a little bit more leeway just because they aren't sure themselves. You know, they made a call, had to go with it, had to be confident about it. But, you know, I think they'll give coaches a little bit more leeway. I think it's the time where umpires know they're right 100%, and I think that's when they're not as apt to let coaches ramble on and on about a certain call. And then some people won't let you argue at all. Some people just, they're so kind of arrogant about it that they won't even just, they'll just kind of cut you off and say, no, I got it.
See, that's what was interesting with the other night. I'm assuming you saw this, a replay or whatever. When Dan got tossed at the end of Louisville's run in Omaha, he's walking away when he gets thrown out. It seemed really odd for that pivotal moment. Frankly, that call that was missed, and then he's de-escalated it, and still the umpire throws him out right there. You feel like that's a situation where, especially calling at that level of game, there'd have been some level of a restraint. It just didn't happen.
Right, and so, yeah, it's all, you never know, I guess, what, without being out there and knowing exactly what's being said, you don't really know. There may be that one thing that set an umpire off or something like that, but yeah, that's kind of what happened to, you know, one time that I was, I guess, ejected. We were playing at TCU, and I felt like most of the time during that argument, I was, like, getting baited into saying, you know, the magic word or the magic phrase that was going to get me ejected or something like that. So I don't know if that's what happened, but, you know, I think that there must have been a little bit of that going on, because I know that Coach Mack is smart. He's a smart guy, obviously, but he knows that, you know, he knows that for him to get thrown out in that situation would not be good for his team, and so there had to have been, I don't know, a little bit of something going on with that umpire, either like a power trip or something like that, because that's usually the ones that are have a quick trigger, if you will.
You felt like the umpire was baiting you that day?
Well, I did. I mean, I felt like he wanted me to say something to arrive. Because he was like, okay, so to kind of set the situation, we were playing at TCU, and it was a tight ball game, and so we had already had a player ejected earlier in the game, and so tension was a little bit high. And so I forget what inning it was, but we had thrown probably, you know, three or four pitches that were not even borderline. I mean, they're legitimate strikes. And so our dugout is going off. You know, our coaching staff's barking. Rory McKean was actually on the mound, and he has thrown his hands up, you know, saying, like, where is that? So I went out there and tried to calm him down, just trying to settle him down a little bit. And then I came back to home plate, and the guy, you just ask him, you know, just trying to defuse the situation. Just, hey, where'd you have those? You know, I had them pretty good. I had them on the plate. You know, I just wanted to see where you had those. And he's like, you know where I had them. I was like, no, I don't. That's why I'm asking you. He's like, come on, man. Don't be like that. Keep your humor about you. I was like, what does that even mean? I was like, what does that even mean? I literally asked him that question. And he goes, you know, man, keep your humor about you. And I was like, I would keep my humor about you, but you're hosing us right now. And apparently that was the magic word.
Oh, that was it?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I was like, I said, because I didn't think I'd be. So then he comes, like, he tosses me, like, behind my back. And so I didn't know what was going on because it was, like, behind me. So he just apparently makes the point, like, you're out of here. And so Coach B, I remember him coming out of the dugout because he thought it was him. And then Rory was, like, had thought it was him as well. And I was sitting there, like, I was the one ejected. I had no idea. And so, yeah, it was pretty interesting. Three guys thought that they were getting ejected. So
what did Mike say to you afterward?
He's like, you're our catcher. You're the one guy that can't do that. You know, we need you to be in the game. So he's like, just, you know, next time be a little bit more careful. That sort of thing.
You called
as bad as I thought.
Yeah, you caught them all. One game to win. Pomeranz, Biddle, or Lance on their best day.
Okay, wow, that's an interesting. Can you rephrase or can you say that again?
Yeah, to win one game, last game of the season, finals of the College World Series or whatever, you get their best games. Biddle, Pomeranz, or Lance. Who you got?
Wow. Can I get them all for three innings apiece?
No, you got to pick one.
Oh man, why would you do that? Geez. So I have to pick one for a full nine innings.
Well, yeah. Who's starting the game? But you're not on pitch counts. They've got to go to the run out of gas.
Gosh. If I had a gun to my head, probably Biddle.
Really? Okay.
I would probably pick Biddle if I had one game, just because of how nasty the thing was. If he can now this is a obviously a hypothetical,
yeah, of course,
because you're talking about Biddle going like a complete nine with an unlimited pitch count, and you're talking about like his stuff is just going to be just as good in the first as it is, or just as good in the ninth as it is in the first, and so that's. And that's kind of like the premise that I'm basing.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because, like, in 2008, for instance, we were playing Georgia in the first round of the SEC tournament. And that was the year they had, like, Gordon Beckham and those guys. You know, they ended up going to the finals of the World Series. And we beat them in that first round. And Lance pitched, like, the first six innings. And the middle came in and closed. And I remember in the ninth inning, all three guys that Georgia had were trying to bunt for base hits with two strikes. And I've never seen that before. And I finally asked one of them, I was like, what are y'all doing? And he's like, dude, we can't hit it. So we might as well try to bunt our way on. I mean, that's what, like, the ultimate respect that they had for Scott was, like, they're bunting with two strikes with nobody on base because they felt like that was their best way to get on base.
This sounds stupid. Was it hard to catch?
Not really. I mean, you've seen it enough times to where...
You knew where it was going, you just didn't have to hit it.
And two, I think I caught him a lot in the fall of 06, and so that 07 spring where he kind of came on the scene and whatever, and I think and this is just my theory on it, I think I started catching him before it became such a phenomenon or whatever that... I didn't really think anything of it, and then all of a sudden it became like this enigma that nobody really could figure out or whatever, and so I didn't really think anything of it. It was either going to be, I mean, all it was is just like a really sharp, late-breaking slider that was very unique to him based on the way he gripped it, his arm angle, and, you know, just a lot of different things. Nobody else could replicate it just because they didn't have the same arm angle as he did.
One more quick break in the show to tell you this part of the interview brought to you by MasterCuts Lawn and Landscape. MasterCuts, full-service lawn maintenance and landscape company serving Oxford, Tupelo, and the surrounding area. Whether you need basic things like landscape design, installation, landscape lighting, irrigation, turf, maintenance, or more, they can help you out when you sign that annual contract. And you mentioned the podcast, First Cut, also on them. Also, they are now partners with Skeeter Beaters. Let them mosquito spray your yard. Take care of that, whether it be for a cookout, for a family get-together, a game at a local park, or just because you'd like to have a little more security from those mosquitoes around your property. Again, either way, give them a call, 662-607-7773 or mastercutslawn.com.
The podcast also brought to you by Comer Heating and Air. Comer Heating and Air has been serving Oxford and the surrounding area for the past 26 years. I've used Comer for air conditioning repair, and you can take my word for it. Their attention to detail, their customer service, and their work is second to none. Comer is an American standard dealer, but they work on any maker model, residential or commercial. Customers get same-day service, free estimates on new units, and preventative maintenance contracts. Visit their website, comerheatingandair.com, or check out their Facebook page. Mention you heard about them on the podcast, and you get $20 off. Contact Eric at 662-934-3846 or Shane at 662-832-8749. Now back to the show.
So you guys didn't really notice that it was anything special, like, I mean, inner squads, the fall? I mean, did people hit him? What was that like?
I mean, we recognized that it was special. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely special. It was just nobody could really figure it out. It's just broke so late. Like, you saw it, I guess from a hitting standpoint, you saw it pretty clear all the way, and then it just dove right under your bat. And it looked like a strike the whole way, like a strike right at your thighs, and then it would all of a sudden just break in the dirt, or something like that. It was wild. And so, I guess people don't realize, too, he had a fastball at, like, 90-plus miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like he didn't throw hard. I mean, he had a really good fastball. He just didn't have to use it. And I think, too, the more that – I think what – eventually kind of led to some of the trials or, you know, some failures that he did have in that 07 season was, like, once that once kind of the book was out on him throughout the conference, and, you know, they would just start pinch hitting late in games, and they pinch hit left-handers, and he couldn't get left-handers out because he would throw the thing and it would just break right into him. He'd hit a lot of guys, or they would just run into it because the, you know, a pitch for left-handers that they hit really well is just a down-and-end pitch, and they were able to get some good barrel on it or find a hole or something like that. So I think in 2008 what really made the difference for him was just the ability to throw the changeup. And I think that I wouldn't say it was the cutter that made Biddle what he was. I think it was the changeup that made him just as effective, or just like the guy that he was, because now he had to pitch to get left-handers out. Whereas people would pinch hit left-handers and be like, okay, I'm just going to throw this changeup, and you're still not going to be able to hit it. And then he got a little bit more control of the cutter, and so now he'd all of a sudden bust a fastball at like 92 and inside, and it looked like 100 because he'd be throwing changeups the whole time, and he'd strike guys out on that. He'd strike guys out on the cutter. He'd go backdoor sometimes. I think the changeup allowed him, you know, another pitch that hitters had in the back of their mind, and now they're up there with, I have no idea what's coming. The slider / cutter, whatever you want to call it, is obviously the best pitch, but you never know when he's going to come with the changeup. You never know when he's going to sneak a fastball in. So obviously right-handers were toast from the beginning, but left-handers, you know, he could definitely get those guys out now with the changeup.
Yeah, everybody talks about, I mean, obviously the key moments. I think you've spoken that documentary too, like in 09 at the end with the button error and then the go-forth walk in that inning. But really that season, if anything, Biddle goes out against Georgia or South Carolina, whomever it was. I mean, he stays healthy. You're probably the best team in the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you'd like. And I know he would like to do that all over again as well. Just because you never know, like, what could have been had he been healthy, had Jake not got hit in the face with the ball in the pregame.
How bad did Baker freak out when he did that?
I don't know. I was already in the bullpen, so okay. I didn't really see it.
I think, say, of all kids to hit Jake Morgan, Nathan Baker, who just I see him, like, going back into the clubhouse and cleaning everything up and going into a corner after that because he's so upset.
Yeah, he definitely didn't feel great about it, that's for sure. I didn't really see it happen. I just heard everybody freaking out. And I was like, oh, God, what just happened? Because then I saw Jake's face, and he was, like, just blood all over his face. It was pretty gross.
Yeah.
In 2009, I thought that if we had Biddle healthy for a full year, you know, because then, like, not anything against Nathan Baker or anything, but, you know, I think I would take Scott Biddle starting game 3 over Nathan Baker.
Well, I mean, and Baker could have been used in different ways. I mean, when he came out of the pen, left-handed, he actually was throwing 94 from the left side when he could just let it go for an inning or two.
Sure, no doubt. And so, yeah, and you, even if you did start Baker, you could still bring Biddle in, you know, because Baker was good for, like, the first 4 to 3rd, 5 innings, something like that. And then they got to him in, like, the 6th, I think,
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you have Biddle coming in the sixth, and you never know what happens. So, it's one of those things. I guess it just wasn't meant to be.
Maybe the most dominant I've ever seen anybody, considering all the circumstances. Did Drew have his normal stuff against Western Kentucky that night?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah, it was really good. I mean, he was just like, just in command of everything. I mean, Hinton caught the majority of the game.
Yeah.
That game. But you could tell that, you know, I warmed him up in the bullpen too. And, you know, it was like, you know, fastball and breaking ball are obviously good, but the changeup was really good as well. And, I mean, in the bullpen, it didn't look, I mean, Drew's stuff was like really good anyway. So it didn't look like anything out of the ordinary.
Right.
But you just knew that everything, he had the ability to throw three pitches for strikes that day, and then, you know, that if he was able to replicate that in the game, then you're going to have a really good shot.
We're actually having Drew on the podcast, I think probably during the All-Star break or sometime here soon. I've talked to him about it a little while ago, but you can answer this question because Neil and I discuss it all the time, and I still laugh about it. It's the one mental image in my head. When Mike comes out to talk to Drew, it felt like every time Drew wasn't paying attention, never said anything back, and stared right over the top of Mike's head.
That's probably true.
Okay.
No, he didn't like. He didn't really talk much at all. He'd go out there and he'd just nod his head. He was like the most. So that was the most interesting thing about the guys that we had that are pitching in the big leagues or were drafted high or what have you is. They're all such different personalities. Like Drew showed zero emotion, you know, even after, you know, that performance that Monday night deal against Western Kentucky, like still it was hard pressed for him to get a smile. It was, you know, he was like the guy that like stone faced. And I think that worked to his advantage because, you know, nothing really fazed him. He'd give up a home run or whatever, and he would literally, I'd go out to the mound and hand him another ball and say, "You good?" And he'd just kind of shrug his shoulders and was like, "Whatever." It's not even like a big deal to him. Whereas like Lance, you know, he's a guy that you don't really, didn't really need your opinion. You'd go out there just to kind of settle him down or being sure he's not ready to kill somebody. Because he's, you know, he was so ultra competitive that he thought he could get anybody out,
mm-hmm.
and usually that worked. So, and then you know, Biddle was the guy who you'd go out there and you'd have to challenge him too because he responded really well to, "Hey man, your stuff's not very good right now. You know, we need you to be better. You know, where's." You know, what happened to Scott Biddle, because you're definitely not him right now. And just stuff that gets under his skin, because then he responds to that stuff. But, you know, I would never say that to Drew, because mm-hmm. he'd probably wouldn't even comprehend what I was saying, because he probably wasn't paying attention.
And Lance would throw the ball at you.
Yeah, then Lance would tell me to get back behind the plate. He'd probably throw an expletive in there, too, but you never know. I think that's the biggest thing about catching. And catching it at Ole Miss as well, kind of going back to the original question of why it's so difficult is because you have to know, not only do you have to know what every pitcher throws, you know, how it moves, how it breaks, you know, actually what pitches that they throw, but you have to know their temperament, you have to know their behavior, that sort of thing, kind of what buttons to press, when to not say anything, you know, when to you know, challenge him or when to pat him on the butt and say, "Hey, you're going to be all right," that sort of thing. So that's probably the difficult part about it was kind of knowing everyone's personality.
Last couple things, appreciate the time. What was the summer like with the Collegiate National Team? Obviously, Mike was with you as well. What do you take from that? What do you remember most about that experience?
Oh, my gosh, it was awesome. You know, I saw a completely different side of Coach B and just how much of a good person that he was. You know, he really took care of me that summer. He almost like treated me like I was his son almost. And even, you know, we took those trips to to Japan, or took the trip to Japan, and we were there for like 2 weeks or something like that. And his wife came with us on the flight, and she was there the whole time. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with them, and I had never really been around them in this setting. So I'd obviously been around Cammy in different capacities, and the boys, and Catherine in different capacities, but I'd never been around Coach B and Cammy, and then in that dynamic, I guess. And so it was really cool to see them, to see, you know, how close that they were, how, you know, seem how really good, to not sound like all gushy or stuff like that, but you know, just how good that their marriage was, and how, you know, in tune with each other they were, because I had just been married for a year. So it was kind of cool to see that. And then just to see how, like, down to earth they both were, and just how, you know, they really did take really good care of me, almost like that I was their own son. And so I took away that and just saw how, I saw the human side of Mike Bianco, which I'd never really seen much of. But just, it was just cool to see how good of a, how respected he was, how good of a game, how he managed the game within his role. Obviously, he was the pitching coach for Jim Schlossnagel at TCU, but just kind of how much Schloss kind of just kind of turned everything pitching-wise over to Coach B and said, hey, you got it, I trust you. And, you know, we ended up losing like two or three games that summer. You know, we swept Cuba. We swept the Cuban national team that it was essentially the World Baseball Classic team. You know, beat them 5 straight games. I mean, we were working with future big leaguers at, like, every position. But at the same time, it was amazing how Coach B was able to command their respect, command their attention, and really get his point across and his system across in such a short time. And for them to be able to respond and respond well, I thought it was pretty cool to see that he could, well, I knew he could do it, but just to see how well it got across to guys of that caliber, where every one of them's probably going to pitch in the big leagues.
Kind of shocking to me a little bit that, you know, you mentioned that it took that trip, and that over the course of a college career, Mike didn't show that side as much just as your head coach.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did. He took an interest. I mean, he took a vested interest in your family life and your academics and things of that nature, and your, you know, just how you're doing overall as a person. But we were just we talked about, you know, and I clarified what I said earlier was, like, we talked about everything but baseball.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking about just, you know, their family, how they were doing, just how, you know, what are their interests, you know, because I'd known Mike Bianco, the baseball coach, but I never knew really the person and what his interests were and things like that. So, and just to see how he was with his wife and how he was even when his kids came and kind of hung around the guys and stuff like that, which we had seen before at Ole Miss. But, you know, he had always took a really big interest in us as people at Ole Miss. I just saw something different from him. That's why I was a little bit different. And, you know, I'll say it to this day, you know, outside of my parents, Mike Bianco and Carl Lafferty have had the big, most, you know, no question, the biggest impact positively on my life than any other person or couple of people, you know, I've ever interacted with, just from helping me grow up as a person, to just the things that they taught, these things that they stressed, the things, you know, what they were about as people. I thought that was, I didn't know it at the time, but now, you know, a few years out, actually more than a few years out, I realized that, you know, kind of the things that they were teaching me, I really have grasped them. I really understood what they were talking about and what they were getting at and what the point of it was. I just feel like I'm a lot better off as a person having been in that program than not having been in the program, if that makes sense. So, yeah. You know, I know I've told the laugh that a couple times, but you know, I really do appreciate, and what they do for everyone that goes through the program is just to, they become better people. And I know that, you know, doesn't always necessarily keep fans happy, but at the same time, you know, I definitely owe them a lot for sure.
Maybe last thing, maybe this isn't fair because you're not around it every day, but I mean, over the course of your career, I guess three super regionals, and clearly the World Series year was only a couple years ago in 14, hosted last year. But if you just had to guess, what has maybe the program missed or is missing that is maybe not allowed them to sustain quite the level of success that was happening during your part of the era?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. You know, I really don't know. I mean, this may sound like a cop-out, but I feel like the times where we were just really close to going to Omaha, I just thought that there was just a lot of bad fortune that went our way, that didn't go our way. For like we mentioned earlier with the Virginia thing, just how everything was, you know, everything that happened seemed like, okay, this isn't meant to be, with Biddle getting hurt and then Jake Morgan getting hit by the ball. You know, the error obviously from Button that just like never happened. You know, it was just some weird things like that. And then, you know, with the Miami, I don't think people realize that, like, we went to we hosted Miami, like everybody in their starting lineup played in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have like nine big leaguers. And so to take them to three games, I thought that was pretty impressive. We were literally like a pitch away. Now, being a pitch away, I mean, almost doesn't count. I mean, I get that. But I'm saying it's not like, you know, then in Arizona State, obviously we got beat in two games there.
Had a lead in the ninth in game one.
What's that?
Had a lead in the ninth in game one. That was when, you know, Cody and Scott struggled and was later to throw Klein.
Right. And then, yeah, so it's not that. I mean, they had a ton of big leaguers in their lineup too, and not to say that, you know, that's the reason that, you know, because we had some guys that could go toe to toe with them, but I don't know if there's any one aspect. I mean, we've always you know, fielded really well. We've always fielded like right around 975, been at the top. I feel like we've pitched really well. You know what? Thinking about it, you know, the more I talk about it, I feel like if they can just get that third guy, like at the back of the rotation, like on a Sunday. And I think they had it in 14 with like Christian Trent and Sam Smith and.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, Sam kind of held it together after Ellis and Trent.
Ellis, yeah, Chris Ellis, yeah, because Chris went on Friday. That's right. So like. That would be a good example. Like when we had Biddle in 2009, we had Pomerantz, Irwin, Biddle, and then Jake Morgan on the back end. I think that was, you know, I think the times where they haven't achieved as much throughout the year is, you know, just, you know, on Sundays. You know, I think they were really good on Sundays in 16. I think I saw a set where they were like 11-3 or like 12-2 on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of the difference. You know, they were in the mix to be a national seed, and then for whatever reason, just, you know, the regional happened. They lost the first two games with that, but you know, I think that would probably be because they're always going to be competitive at the plate. They're always going to pitch really well on the front and the back ends. Always going to run the bases aggressively. Play defense really well. But I think just if anything, maybe like a third, you know, a Sunday, you know, a legitimate Sunday guy that, you know, could kind of hold the fort and, you know, keep him in the game on Sunday where they really have to, you know, win a swing game or, you know, go for the sweep or avoid getting swept or something like that.
Yeah, I know that makes sense. Well, I appreciate catching up with you today. We'll talk to you again, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, yeah, man, appreciate it. No problem, anytime.
Our thanks to Brett Basham for joining us on the Oxford Exxon podcast. He joined us via the Rebel Locker Room hotline, the Rebel Locker Room, West Jackson Avenue in Oxford. It's the place to go to get all of your officially licensed Ole Miss gear, all the colors, all the styles, everything you're looking for the upcoming football season is right there at the Rebel Locker Room in Oxford. on West Jackson Avenue. Ole Miss football tickets available at olemisstix.com. That's olemisstix.com. Speaking of football season, tailgating season right around the corner as well. 7 South Tailgating can get you ready for the tailgating season. 7 South Tailgating, equipped with the largest staff in the Grove, that can service any of your tailgating needs. They offer SEC only, full season packages, rental packages. Fans can provide their own gear. 7 South will set it up for them. 7 South offers complete setup, game day concierge, post-game trash removal, equipment breakdown, and year-round storage for people who tailgate anywhere in the Grove, the Circle, or on the outskirts of campus. It's the largest vendor in the Grove, yet they still manage to know each customer personally by name. They typically sell out for every game, so visit 7southtailgating.com today to secure your spot. If you give 7 South a try for one season, you'll never tailgate without them again. You can get in touch with Kyle Thornton at 662-321-1682. The podcast also brought to you by Grenada Nissan. If you're in the market for a Nissan vehicle, it's the place to go. They've got new Nissans, previously owned Nissans, and great lease deals. You can get a 1990s price on a lease deal on a brand new Nissan vehicle at Grenada Nissan. It's GrenadaNissanUSA.com.
I'm going to move on to the gambling in a second. Like I said, thanks to Brett. Seeing this morning, Steph Curry has accepted an invitation to compete in a web.com tour event. I'm annoyed by this on multiple fronts. It's good PR for the PGA Tour, I guess. It's going to get people at the event. It's whatever. Give this exemption to somebody actually trying to make a living playing golf. Maybe it's a Tebow argument, but I'm bothered.
It is the Tebow argument. And if you notice, the Mets are positioning themselves to call him.
Yeah, did you hear that bull crap from the GM about the reasons for it?
Oh, yeah. It's a joke.
Talking like exit velocities and stuff? Come on. Come on.
I mean, just say out loud, we're going to be out of it in September. We're a poorly run organization. We're a disaster. And we need someone to sell tickets in New York and compete for the back page, because the Yankees are actually good with good young players. And Brian Cashman's done a really good job of, give Cashman credit. Last couple of years, he realized, hey, we're not good enough. And he unloaded some players. He rebuilt the organization. They now have a really talented young organization. And they're in it. They're going to play meaningful games in September. The Mets aren't. And the Mets are going to bring Tim Tebow up to sell tickets and to get media attention. And the media, being the stooges that we are, we will participate in the same way that this golf thing, instead of people saying what you just said, which is, wait a minute, he's taking an exemption from someone who's actually trying to make a living playing golf so that it'll get attention. And it will get lots of attention.
Yeah, he's a good golfer. Incredibly above average, but he's not a professional golfer.
Well, I mean, something tells me Steph Curry doesn't need golf. He doesn't need a pro golf career to make it work.
Yeah, and everybody's going to say, oh, it's just one tournament, it's fine, shut up, don't be the no fun guy. But I don't know.
I wouldn't have a problem if you said we're going to give him an exemption in addition to someone else. We're just going to add a spot.
And look, maybe they are. I've seen nothing on that, but normally those things are pretty hard cap from a person standpoint.
No, he's probably taking someone else's opportunity. But people will follow him around. People will hot take about his swing. It'll be lots of publicity, in much the same way that the Tebow thing, which will happen in September. What will be interesting will be, let's say, the Mets play the Cubs in middle of September. The Cubs don't appear to be good enough to run away with the Central. And the Brewers and the Cardinals don't appear to be good enough to make the Cubs pay for it. Real chance that the Cubs are playing meaningful baseball in September. The Mets go to Chicago, middle of September. Is it fair to the Brewers, as an example, or the Cardinals, as an example, for the Cubs to face a Mets team that has Tim Tebow in the lineup?
Oh, you think they're going to play him, not just put him on the roster?
Oh, yeah.
After he makes one or two more different minor league spots to sell those jerseys, too.
Yeah, he's going to play in high A for a little while.
He's going to play in double A.
They're going to move him to double A.
He's not going to go to triple A, my opinion.
They're going to move him to double A, and then they're going to hand select a couple of stats, and then they'll put him up in September, and we'll have the big national debate about Tim Tebow. And the Tim Tebow defenders will say this is an attack on Christianity, and the Tim Tebow attackers will feed that narrative by talking about whether he's a virgin or not, or whether he's gay or not. And meanwhile, people like you and me, who are fairly sane, will simply say he's eating an opportunity from a young person in the Mets organization who's probably earned either a cup of coffee or who has earned a look.
Yeah, I just...
taking at-bats that another person could use.
No, you're right. It's exactly what's going to happen.
And I couldn't care less about his faith. I don't care about his sexual orientation. I don't care about his virginity status. None of those things matter at all to me. Couldn't care less. I don't hate Tebow. I don't care one way or the other about Tim Tebow. Couldn't care less.
Is it a one-year deal? We're not going to be doing this in 18, too, are we?
I don't know. But he's making a complete mockery of the system.
You blame him?
No. I think there's something off about him, but that's there's something off about all of us.
Yeah, of course. We all have flaws.
Yeah,
I don't blame him necessarily, and this is just an observation playing psychiatrist. I feel like he constantly has to have attention.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely an attention whore. Needs it.
And
he'll
it.
Turn around and people will say, well, he uses his platform for whatever. Oh, okay. I mean, my response to that is no one is stopping Tim Tebow. No one is stopping Tim Tebow from going into ministry or going into some sort of a full-time, what's the word I'm looking for when you go
some type
on,
of evangelism?
Yeah, no one is stopping him from going on missions, becoming a full-time missionary. No one. So go do it. You don't need professional sports to make that work. Yeah. He has a big enough following. He could impact lives, continue to impact lives positively. But I don't blame him. I blame the Mets.
Well, we can't go a podcast without mentioning something NCAA related. So today, that is sports gambling. Supreme Court on Tuesday. Now, it's going to hear arguments in the state of New Jersey's quest to legalize sports gambling, actually overruling the U.S. Solicitor General's opinion, which is not something that typically happens. The Solicitor General said the case was not worthy of the Supreme Court's time. They said it actually is, as New Jersey's been seeking to legalize sports betting for a pretty good while. They've got a sagging casino industry. And they're being opposed by all the major U.S. sports leagues and the NCAA in federal court. NCAA jumping into a sports gambling thing. I'm shocked. At issue here is the Federal Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992, which essentially banned sports gambling in all but a couple states, obviously Nevada being the main one. But it hasn't stopped the spread of sports betting in the United States, with some studies estimating that hundreds of billions, that's with a B, of dollars are wagered illegally in the United States each year. New Jersey says that it should be up to the states to decide whether they have legalized gambling. And even Adam Silver, even though the NBA's had a kind of a hard line on it the other direction, Adam Silver has long supported federally regulated sports gambling, while the NFL and NHL, of course, are putting franchises in Las Vegas with the Raiders, and then was it the Knights with the NHL. So this is opening up, Neil, at least the possibility. Because to me, if the Supreme Court says they want to hear it, they've got a pretty good idea where they're going, or at least somebody on that panel does. If this is passed, the way I understand it, every state will eventually be able to, or overruled, I guess, every state will eventually be able to determine whether they want to have some type of sports book or betting on games in their state. It's a huge deal.
It is, and it's a revenue opportunity for states. I mean, I've always thought it was ridiculous that just one and sometimes two states in the country can have it and no one else can. It's a revenue opportunity. People are betting on sports. Why not legalize it and make money?
Yeah, it doesn't seem, to me, it just doesn't seem constitutional that you go, well, because you're grandfathered in Nevada, you can have at it, and then maybe Delaware, Oregon, whatever the other states are, you can kind of dabble in it, but everybody else, it's off limits.
It's ridiculous.
Mississippi has casinos. Mississippi is dead against the lottery. Where are they going to fall on a sports book?
Oh, they'll be against it.
Makes a lot of sense.
They'll be against it.
You can go spend all your money in a penny slot, but nope, don't go bet on the Broncos.
All the deep South states. Well, not all. Louisiana will be for it. Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee will be against it. Georgia will be interesting. Florida will be for it. People bet on sports.
What is the argument? I mean, this is fascinating to me, and I know I'm talking to the choir, and I know that it's a bit rhetorical. But with sports betting, there's definitely a semblance of skill to that. It's not just a lottery. It's not just a crapshoot. You're doing analysis. You're analyzing your picks. But take out sports betting. What is the difference between buying a lottery ticket, which you're buying anyway in another state and giving that state money, and putting a penny in a penny slot and pulling a lever? There's no function or skill to a slot machine.
No.
What's the difference?
How
is one perfectly acceptable and one's perfectly unacceptable?
I've always said this. Like you said, you're preaching to the choir.
Mississippi congressman, I forget who it was, that said the thing about, well, it's protecting people from wasting their money or whatever. They can go to Tunica and put as much money as they want on a blackjack hand. Or just dump every quarter they have in a slot machine.
Or drive across the bridge into Louisiana and spend their entire paycheck on lottery tickets.
Or Memphis. Yeah, supplement those states' education systems.
Yeah, I was just taking someone who's like in Vicksburg, for example.
Give money to Tops.
You drive across the bridge and into Delhi and go to a convenience store and buy all the tickets you can afford.
The other thing this might do is create it where the NCAA starts putting events in Vegas or in Nevada as well, by the way. That's the other offset of this.
Well, yeah, that whole argument of you can't put events in Vegas, they would be jeopardized, is silly. The events, that's always the fear of any sport, is that they get compromised. The integrity of the sport is compromised by illegal gambling. The event being in Las Vegas doesn't really make it all that much more at risk than an event in Nashville, for example.
Yeah. In December 2015, NCAA President Mark Emmert referred to, quote, what often seems to be a hypocritical stance by the association regarding Las Vegas. 11 states have legalized daily fantasy sports betting, which the NCAA has defined as sports betting. The NCAA has staged or will stage championship events in at least 4 of those states, including Indiana, where their home base is. But Nevada's been off the table. Just another example here of the hypocritical nature of all of it.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
I don't know what else I can say about it. You know how I feel about it. It's crazy.
So, nonetheless, that's the news for the day. We'll be back soon with, we're going to talk to Corey Keyes about basketball scheduling. Ole Miss announced their non-conference basketball schedule this week. So, that on the next podcast. And then, thanks to Brett Basham, we will talk to you soon.